Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For several years, Venezuela has been a country in crisis. The economic woes are so deep that inflation has risen to nearly 700%. The IMF predicts it might soar higher than 2,000 by next year. Four-fifths of Venezuelans currently live in poverty. Four-fifths. Food shortages are so severe that 73% of Venezuelans reported losing weight last year, an average of 19 pounds per person. This is according to a recent issue of Harper's Magazine. Access to electricity, water, adequate medical attention, and health care have all become painfully scarce. And this all underscores the political turmoil of the last few years. The leadership of Nicolas Maduro, successor to the popular socialist president Hugo Chavez, has turned into what many are calling a near dictatorship. In the midst of all of this, the shortages, the political turmoil, the people have taken to the streets, and there have been violent protests, 124 deaths so far this year. So on today's Your Call, we are going to talk about how Venezuela got here, what is actually contributing to this political and economic crisis. Today, we're joined by Alejandro Velasco, Associate Professor of Latin American History at New York University, Executive Editor of the NACLA Report on the Americas, a quarterly magazine covering Latin American and the United States. He's also author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. And Alejandro joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Hi, Alejandro. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Good. Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Mike Gonzalez, a retired professor of Latin American Studies at the University of Glasgow. Mike has written widely on Latin American politics and culture, including a biography of Chavez. It's called Hugo Chavez, Socialist for the 21st Century. Hi, Mike. Thank you for joining us. He's joining us from Spain.
Hi, hello.
Hi.
I didn't hear the question. Sorry.
Oh, I just introduced you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi.
Hi. We're also joined by Ana Vanessa Herrero. She's a reporter with the New York Times in Caracas. She has been covering the crisis in Venezuela since it began back in 2014, and she joins us on the line from Caracas. Hi, Ana. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Ana, I've been reading all of your stories, and these statistics are shocking. I mean, we had to make sure that we got our numbers correct. I mean, food shortages are so severe that 73% of Venezuelans have reported losing weight. Can you first start off, we'll talk about the politics, obviously, but just start off by talking about what is currently happening on the ground. What are you hearing from people?
Well, right now, things here in Venezuela are about the same as last week. I'm just going to talk about the context right now. The same amount of tension, we can say, without any protests on the streets beyond the ones being done for the lack of food, the lack of medicine, and just about everything that is missing that is a lot. And inflation is making the people fear for the future. We're talking about prices that are increasing basically every week. And the black market change rate, which is the one used for every purchase, left the minimum wage in less than $10 a month. That is the situation on the economic side right now. On the political side, people are just trying to understand the opposition decisions on going to governor's elections in October, since it was them who pointed out the electoral power and the elections for the Constituent Assembly were a fraud. So now people are asking themselves what to do, in the future. If they have to buy lots of food, they don't have the money to buy it, what's going to happen in the elections? The Venezuelans have to vote or don't, or they don't want to vote. It's really confusing right now. It's really complicated for everyone in the story here in the country.
Mm. And Ana, is the population of Venezuela today about 23 million?
About, yes.
Okay. And according to NACLA, about 1.5 million people, mostly middle-class professionals and youth, have left Venezuela over the past decade, seeking opportunities elsewhere.
Yes. There are studies that says almost 2 million. I would say definitely 1.5 million have left the country. And it's still a really bad scenario for Venezuelans and for the future, even if the government changes. Experts say what's going to happen with the country, since everyone that studied here that's supposed to make a future of the country are just moving to other cities and other parts of the world. And they're right now working, and they are not thinking about coming back, because this is not going to get better in the next couple of years, even if the government changes. And when you go to their airport, it's really sad. I happened to go there last Saturday, and I saw at least 10 families crying their eyes out, just because they were saying goodbye to young people, to 18 years old, 25 year old, to families that were just leaving Venezuela thinking and looking for a better future. And the other part is that people that are leaving Venezuela are just engineers, doctors, are working in other countries, for example, in the United States or in Spain. They're working as McDonald's. They're working as taxi drivers, which is okay, but they didn't study for that. So they're not even, you know, working on what they studied for.
That is Ana Vanessa Herrero. She's a reporter with the New York Times based in Caracas. And Alejandro Velasco, you are the editor of the NACLA Report on the Americas, a quarterly magazine covering Latin America. And again, before we get into the politics, I just want to ask you about what is happening on the ground. I mean, we're talking about a country of 23 million people. And according to statistics, 4/5 of those 23 million are currently living in poverty. People are losing weight. I was just reading an article this morning about malaria. So many people are concerned that that's going to skyrocket because medicines are not available. Can you also just talk about the human crisis that's happening on the ground?
Yeah, actually, just to correct you a little bit, the population is a little bit larger. It's closer to 30 million.
30 million.
Okay. Yeah, but you know, that doesn't minimize to any extent the crisis. To a large extent, of course, it makes it worse, because it means that even more people are suffering through what you've mentioned. You know, one of the factors that I think gets missed here is that the crisis, as severe as it is, doesn't affect everybody equally. Venezuela is also increasingly highly unequal country after what had been, you know, pretty significant gains under the Hugo Chavez administration, largely as a result of Venezuela's historic dependency on oil and the significant, you know, boom in oil prices that Venezuela experienced between 2004 and roughly around 2014. That most of those gains in terms of access to food, access to health, access to education have been basically wiped out and are now, in fact, growing worse than they were before, which is to say that, you know, a large part of the human crisis is really this enormous sense of having lost something that had been gained, which affects people dramatically in terms of, as Anna mentioned, hopes for the future. There's a real sense of dejection, a real sense of hopelessness, a real sense that, you know, we had an opportunity at a moment in time, especially for popular sectors who, you don't have access to dollars, who don't have access to the black market, and as a result, really depend on what are the meager sort of remaining overtures on the part of the government through you know, subsidized food that comes every couple of weeks through these programs called CLAPs, which of course binds them in a tremendously dependent relationship to the government. So, you know, there's I think that on top of just how hard living conditions are, there's that sense of dejection, that sense of hopelessness that comes as a result of having experienced momentarily an increase in their standards of living, only to have seen them drop precipitously in a very short period of time.
Mike Gonzalez, you're a retired professor of Latin American Studies at the University of Glasgow. You wrote a book about Hugo Chavez. Can you also talk about what is happening on the ground? And is at this point, is there anything that we're missing or you feel is missing in the media?
Well, first of all, I agree with Alejandro with his perspective. But I think maybe it will help us to bear in mind that in 2012, Venezuela was commended for the not the elimination of poverty, but for the tremendous reduction in the levels of poverty and extreme poverty. Now, these are coming back, and they're coming back. They've come back in the last 4 or 5 years. So that contributes to what Alejandro was talking about. It's a combination of things. There is a real material crisis, a difficulty for sustaining life day to day, a kind of, you see it and hear it with people's obsession with just getting food, finding the things they need, which seem to occupy most of their time. So that's one element. But the other element, and he's quite right, is what we could call the loss of hope. You know, when you talk about people leaving Venezuela, you're talking about a very, 20% of the population who are able to leave Venezuela. The vast majority of the population who were the beneficiaries of the beginnings of the Chavista revolution, the beneficiaries of the social programs and so on, the people who supported Chavez with such fervor, these are the people who are now suffering. So there is a division, and I'm sure that your other participants will agree with me that a short walk around Caracas will tell you that this poverty and this scarcity and this difficulty is very unevenly distributed. There are people in Caracas, in the east of Caracas, where the restaurants are full, who live very well, who have the dollars to maintain very, high standards of living. So it's the combination of all these things: the loss of hope, the decline in the living standards of the majority of population, the visible inequality they live with every day, and the loss of hope.
Ana, you're in Caracas. Can you describe what it's like when you walk around that city?
Well, I agree on that, because last year it was like that. I mean, restaurants were full, but still, you go, if you go into slums, you would see starving children all around. But right now, the situation is completely different, and that's what's amazing about Venezuelan situation, is that it can change over a few months. I mean, if you leave the country in January and you return in May, you're not going to find the same country. Right now, restaurants are not full. And now you can see who's, handling dollars and who's not. But most people are not capable of having dollars in their pockets. And what you're facing is people really thin, children starving, all malnourished, and, numbers are just amazing. And if you go to the hospitals, the situation gets worse. There's a case that I know I'm familiar with, because I try to go every week to the main hospital in Caracas, the Universitario, and there's only at least 8 children with malnourished children there. And, doctors and nurses tell me that situation is getting worse. Not only this, but people are starting to abandon children, babies, on the streets, on others' houses, to see if they can survive.
Wow. Are humanitarian groups on the ground there, Anna?
Well, yeah, they are, but they are not openly here. You are not going to find, for example, I wouldn't like to mention the ones that I know that are here, because they are not very public about it. Hmm. But they are definitely here, and they're trying to make their best to help the people with and deal with the politics, because Venezuelans deal with two things, main things: the economy and politics. And humanitarian groups that come here, very big organizations, have to deal with the fact that the government doesn't want the world to know that there's a humanitarian crisis here. And that, yes, they're here definitely, and they're trying to help.
Mm. That is Ana Vanessa Herrero. She's a reporter for the New York Times in Caracas. She's been covering this crisis since it began in 2014. We're also joined by Mike Gonzalez, retired professor of Latin American Studies at the University of Glasgow, author of the biography Hugo Chavez, Socialist for the 21st Century. Alejandro Velasco is associate professor of Latin American History at NYU, executive editor of the NACLA Report on the Americas, and author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the political and the economic crisis in Venezuela. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. What do you make of the news coming out of Venezuela? It's really staggering. If you're connected to Venezuela, if you're from there, if you've lived there, if you have family, what experiences or concerns do you want to share? What are you hearing from family who are there? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave us a comment on Twitter at yourcallradio. Let's spend a little time talking about the gains made by the poor and the working classes under Hugo Chavez. Mike Gonzalez, you wrote a book about Hugo Chavez. I mean, I know these are big questions. We can talk an hour for every question that I ask you. But how would you summarize the gains made under Chavez?
The Chavista project was to take the income from oil and redistribute it among the population. That was the straightforward statement. And the way it was interpreted was, in a sense, especially after a decade, the 90s, in which extreme poverty had risen, in which living standards, the majority, had fallen dramatically because of structural adjustment policies from the IMF, as usual. The promise was to restore the standard of living, which had been much higher in the 80s, was to use the resources from oil to establish, I suppose, the foundations of a kind of welfare state. In other words, social services, health provision, education, housing, and so on. These were the main areas, and certainly the first move was to nationalize PDVSA, the oil corporation, and with the funds and redirect oil funds from, you know, which had been largely exported until then, and redirect them to funding and financing social programs. Now, there is a problem with that, which is that, in a sense, the promise was to, first of all, use that income for the benefit of the majority. Secondly, longer term, to diversify the economy to lessen dependence on oil, and in doing that, create new productive sectors in the economy. But the distribution of the oil wealth was really done in what they call in Spanish a kind of asistencialista way, a kind of social welfare idea in which the government became the provider for the majority of the population of necessary services. But the development of a productive sector of the economy very quickly ground to a halt, with the result that it created a kind of culture of dependency, I think, which is a dangerous thing to say, I know, but I think that's what it did do. It created a culture of dependency, an expectation that the state would provide without there being a kind of reciprocal contribution from the people on the ground. Nevertheless, in the first, I'd say, the first presidency of Chavez up to 2006, there was a distinct and visible improvement in people's lives, particularly in education. That was very impressive. Mm-hmm. The development of education, its extension into hitherto neglected communities and so on, that was one thing. Health provision certainly improved, and that improved largely with the arrival of Barrio Dentro, which was the Cuban run health service in the poor areas, which up till then had no provision. The hospital system did improve somewhat, but it was largely provision for the poorest of basic health care, and that was real too, and people celebrated that, and that was a very real improvement. And as to housing, well, there were schemes to build housing that came a little later through PDVSA. So there was a visible and tangible improvement in the lives of the poorest.
Mm. Alejandro, what would you add?
Well, I think beyond those material improvements that Mike mentions, there are a lot of intangible improvements that Chavez, especially again in those early years of his presidency, brought about, and it had to do with the idea that people who had long been marginalized, left out not just of the oil pie, but really of the sense of the nation. I'm talking about, you know, poor sectors that had, even in the 1970s era of the early, you know, the prior oil boom, had reached, you know, levels of 50% of the population being poor, and those levels rose dramatically in the 1980s when there was an oil bust, and then even more so in the 1990s during an era of really severe kind of privatization and retrenchment of social welfare policies. And what Chavez did really was to say that these populations that had been left out not only needed to be brought back in, but that they had what he called protagonismo. They should be protagonists in their lives. And the constitution that he, you know, that he implemented in 1999, which was then ratified through popular vote, really made that sense of protagonism on the part of the population, especially these long excluded sectors, and participation a bedrock of what a new kind of Venezuela would look like. And what that generated before this period that Mike talks about in terms of dependency and sort of cultures of dependency was a tremendous effervescence of participation at the local level. You know, sectors that had previously been primarily dependent on political parties, began to organize into community groups, into local level groups that over time became something more formalized around communal councils. And the idea later on was to turn those into communes, and that has not yet happened to that extent. But that effervescence of participation and protagonism was something that drove much further than just the concrete material gains. And that's what I was mentioning before, that the sense that moment you know, has been lost as a result of the government now pretty much just trying to hang on to power rather than to you know, to create spaces for greater participation. That, I think, is the deeper tragedy. Maybe not the deeper tragedy, but the other element of the tragedy that Venezuela has really fallen into. Hmm.
Many elements of the tragedy. You were both talking about education, and Anna, you and your New York Times colleague Nicholas Casey wrote a beautiful story called "Venezuela Musicians Rise Up After Violist Is Killed at a Protest." You wrote about Armando Canizales. He was just 18 years old, and he died in June. He was part of what sounded like an incredible state-run music program for the poor. You write that for four decades, the state-financed program trained hundreds of thousands of musicians across social classes, an achievement unheard of anywhere else in Latin America, and one that has left the music world in envy. You write that its young prodigy, Gustavo Dudamel, became an international star and now leads the Los Angeles Philharmonic. And this was a pet project of Hugo Chavez.
No,
it wasn't.
Before Chavez.
Oh, it was before Chavez.
Was before Chavez.
Okay.
But it's definitely true that with Chavez, it became greater. It became more wonderful, and he had a lot of money. And Chavez actually believed a lot in that program. And even though it was created before the Chavismo started, it's true that with the Chavismo, it expanded. It had more resources. And it's now copied in mostly every city in the world. Not every city, but in a lot of cities in the world. Basically, for example, Japan is it's an example that I know very closely, because I had the opportunity to go to Japan with the orquesta, the sistema, what we call el sistema, and they copied the same. And in Africa also, or Latin America, in the United States, there are what we call nucleus of the sistema, little groups of children, different, they, you know, without remarks of any class, that can make this music. But sadly, right now, that's not the situation that we're having. Right now, they don't have the resources. Right now, a lot of musicians are just leaving the country. They can't afford living out of music anymore, and they're doing other stuff. So even that has been taken away from Venezuela.
Mm. And you report that the salaries of the teacher have been eroded by inflation. A basic maintenance of the main concert hall in Caracas has been neglected. It suddenly flooded one night in 2016. Mm-hmm. This is such a beautiful story. Again, this violist's name was Armando Canizales. He was only 18 years old, and I hope you can take the time to read it at yourcallradio.org. It was written by today's guest, Ana Vanessa Herrero. She's a New York Times reporter in Caracas, along with her colleague Nicholas Casey. We're also joined today by Mike Gonzalez, retired professor of Latin American Studies at the University of Glasgow, and Alejandro Velasco, associate professor of Latin American History at New York University. Coming up after the break, we will talk about why Hugo Chavez chose Nicolas Maduro. And we will talk about how we got here to this point. How is it that Venezuela is in such an intense economic and political crisis? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KLW. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's On Point from WBUR in Boston. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Eilat Waldman and Michael Chabon about their new book, Kingdom of Olives and Ash. It's a collection of essays by international writers that bear witness to the human cost of 50 years of Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we will be discussing media coverage of what has been happening in Charlottesville. There have been some incredible stories coming out of there, and I hope you can join us for that. If you saw anything that caught your attention, please email them to us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the political and economic crisis that is happening in Venezuela. You've probably heard these dire statistics. Venezuela is a country of about 30 million people, and food shortages are so severe, 73% of the population has reported losing weight, an average of about 19 pounds per person. Access to electricity, water, adequate medical attention, health care have become painfully scarce. We're talking about what is happening on the ground and how Venezuela got here with three guests: Alejandro Velasco, associate professor of Latin American history at New York University, author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. Mike Gonzalez is author of a biography of Chavez called Hugo Chavez, Socialist for the 21st Century. He's a retired professor of Latin American Studies at the University of Glasgow. And Ana Vanessa Herrero is a reporter with the New York Times in Caracas. She's been covering the crisis since it began. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. All right, so let's talk about what happened after Chavez died. Nicolas Maduro was handpicked. He was a less popular successor, according to reports. What do we need to know about Nicolas Maduro? Alejandro, what do we need to know about him?
Maduro was a union organizer. He was a longtime bus operator in the metro system in Caracas. He sort of rose to the ranks of Chavismo as a member of the civilian wing. There were long two wings in Chavismo: one, a military wing, which Chavez came from as a military man himself. He had, of course, staged an unsuccessful coup in 1992 before coming to power democratically in 1998. So Maduro was part of the civilian wing, and he had risen through the ranks to become foreign minister under Chavez. And he was foreign minister. He held that position for almost 8 years, which at the time of Chavez's death was, I think, seen by Chavez as a plus because he had remained distant enough from the machinations internally in the domestic sphere in Venezuela, such that he could come in and not really be part of any one of the various factions that had risen up in Chavismo. And he also, of course, had a lot of international ties, especially at a time when Venezuela was a really prominent player, in part because of its oil rents in Latin America and internationally as well, in terms of projecting its image abroad. And so I think Chavez felt that because of these two things, that, you know, he had some he had a lot of standing internationally, as well as not being embroiled in the domestic battles as closely as others had been, that would provide Maduro with an opportunity to come in and really steer the ship after his death. Of course, what happened is that as soon as the election that brought him to power happened, it was the narrowest election in Chavista history, and that already undermined Maduro's credibility significantly and set the stage for the series of political battles that would unfold later. On top of the fact that Maduro just lacks the basic charisma that that Chavez had in order to be able not just to bring in people that were already inclined to support Chavismo, but one of the things that Chavez was always able to do was to really sort of draw in the opposition in ways that Maduro has been unable to do. So that, coupled with the dramatic fall in oil prices after 2014, really left Maduro with a very difficult position in terms of trying to steer what remained of Chavismo.
Before I ask Mike what he would add, can you define the opposition? That word is often thrown around when we talk about Venezuela, but can you define it?
Can I first of all go back to your previous question? First of all, we have to look at what happened between 2006 and 2013 when Chavez died. Chavismo didn't just go on being the same thing. Chavez's popularity really didn't decline. He remained hugely popular. But his government and his regime changed, and it changed in the sense that it began to be increasingly bureaucratic, and the state, a corrupt and corporate state which had existed in Venezuela since the 50s, and which he had resolved and promised to transform in a new direction, as Alejandro mentioned earlier, in a participatory and protagonistic direction, clearly was not changing. On the contrary, a new layer of bureaucracy was emerging, including Maduro and others, which increasingly was taking control over the system, which was becoming increasingly corrupt. And this was not a secret. Everybody in Venezuela knew perfectly well and could offer personal examples and personal testimony of how much corruption there was. The oil money flowed through in huge amounts, but according to the then economy minister, Giordani, $500 billion, quote, disappeared, unquote, which is another way of saying that they were diverted in corrupt directions into the enrichment of individuals and so on. So by the time Chavez died, he was holding sway over a very different government and a very different society from the one that he had set in motion. He was, and in fact, to me, I think one of the most important documents of his whole career was his very last, his national plan for 13 to 19, which had a preface, in which was effectively a confession of failure on Chavez's part. He said, "We haven't transformed the state, and we have to turn the tiller hard," he said, "dar un golpe de timón, because we have got it wrong and we have to change direction." And the truth is that under Maduro, it didn't change direction. That layer of powerful bureaucrats became more and more powerful. The corruption became more and more profound. And the oil price simply, if you like, precipitated things, but it wasn't the cause. The problem was that oil revenues had simply disappeared, disappeared into corrupt pockets. So that when the decline in the oil price came, the reserves were low. There was very little capacity in the state to actually deal with the fall in the oil price, and the crisis the crisis ensued. Everything else that Alejandro said about Maduro is quite right. But I think if we can't understand the situation now unless we understand those developments in the latter half of the first decade and what things were, the point things were at when Chavez died, and the nature of his criticism. The layer of people who came into power were very different from Chavez, although they all claimed to be his reincarnation. Hmm. But they certainly weren't. And it became more corrupt, less controlled, and more and more a regime which was failing.
Alejandro, what are your thoughts about Mike's comments and opinion that it's very important to talk about the corruption that happened under Chavez and to look at the oil revenues that disappeared during that time?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's accurate. I think this, though, points to a well, two things. One, it's certainly true that to think about what's going on in Venezuela today, it's really important to distinguish what Chavismo was and it wasn't. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to distinguish these two periods in time that I think Mike correctly points to, an earlier period before this dramatic rise in oil prices, during which there was tremendous kind of popular effervescence, people organizing, in large part because there weren't those kind of concrete improvements to their lives. They were banking on the possibility of a different Venezuela. And then after that, when oil prices really skyrocket, and then that leads Venezuela down a very familiar path that it had gone in before, which is this dependency on oil and the asistencialismo that Mike mentioned. But I think the other part of it too is just to say the following, which is, you know, what Chavez also sort of unleashed was a real battle between definitions of democracy. So that on the one side, what you had was a very sort of classic understanding of democracy as a liberal democracy, you know, institutions of government that mutually check its power, but are rather tutelary and relegated to periodic elections, and that's really where participation lies, and a much more sort of radical understanding of democracy in which institutions of the state are seen rather as hampers on the popular will rather than as their tools. And so one of the things that Chavez's vision of democracy from the beginning was attempting to do was to dismantle that prior existing institutionalism, which then is what contributes really significantly to the corruption that Mike mentions, insofar as when oil prices skyrocket and flood Venezuela's coffers with petrodollars, there are really no checks to the way or any kind of accountability to the way that those revenues are going to be spent. And so, you know, Yordani, who Mike mentioned, the prior finance minister, planning minister, you know, he talks about $500 billion sort of squandered, but the fact is that we just don't know how much money was squandered because there were no sort of effective checks that were placed. And I think this speaks to your question before about, you know, what is the opposition? How do we understand the opposition? The fact is that the opposition is a very heterogeneous group. You know, it goes from sort of far right to, you know, far left sectors. And it's also an opposition that historically has been, you know, not fully committed to the idea of democracy. Those early years that we talk about Chavez were also years during which the opposition, you know, staged a coup, staged an oil industry strike that was extremely, grievous for Venezuela's economy. It boycotted elections. And each one of these steps, what it actually did was give Chavez and Chavismo more power. Rather than less, because it then controlled the military, controlled the oil industry, controlled Congress, rather as a result of these moves by the opposition. So, you know, it's only been over the last 6-7 years that the opposition has settled in a more democratic path. But of course, it comes at a moment when Maduro in power sees his own survival very much hampered, and so those, you know, ironically and paradoxically, those, you know, when the opposition has now chosen a more democratic path, finds those paths further and further curtailed. So that's what's leading to this tremendous political stalemate that we see now.
And Ana, you are a reporter with the New York Times in Caracas. You've been covering this crisis mm-hmm. since 2014. Do you know what it was like for reporters who tried to uncover the corruption, for reporters who tried to follow the money?
Right now, you mean?
Under Chavez.
Oh, well, it wasn't so hard. I mean, they were more careful. They were more cautious on how they did it. Anyways, if you followed the money, it wasn't as hard as you could imagine, and it wasn't as dangerous as it is right now. Now, the difference between Chavez and Maduro right now in the corruption aspect is that if you try to uncover that, you're basically putting yourself into jail if they catch your name, if they know who you are. But it's easier right now than it was with Chavez. Right now, I'm amazed about how easy they make that for us, because they have no remarks whatsoever on how they spend their money. They're very public with how they spend their money, and they're not very cautious in who they talk to. So it's really easy right now, but it's a lot more dangerous than before.
We have a question from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I just wanted to, see if we can follow up with the person from NACPA said, which is that we need to really look at how much the opposition has contributed to this, including the United States. The CIA, head of the CIA, recently said that they were going to continue to try to destabilize Venezuela. And when you talk about corruption, I have no doubt there is corruption, but I have to say that's the same thing that was said against Salvador Allende prior to the Republicans, Nixon, overthrowing Allende, and they created all kinds of chaos there. So it makes it very hard to know from, mainstream media like the New York Times and others that have unwittingly parroted CIA information when this is true and when it's not, and what part the U.S. and the opposition has played in creating this chaos. So I guess I'd like to talk about that more.
Okay. All right. Well, since you singled out the New York Times, Anna, do you want to respond to Lisa? Were you able to hear her?
I am sorry, but I'm having a lot of trouble hearing her.
Okay, so Lisa wanted to talk a little bit more about the United States' role in all of this. She also feels like the mainstream media tends to parrot the CIA's line when it comes to Venezuela. How would you respond to that?
Well, right now we can openly talk about the influence of Washington, of the United States, in politics, in Venezuelan politics, since President Trump has been really open about his feelings towards the opposition and towards Maduro. But actually before, there's always been allegations and reunions, meetings between opposition and congressmen or members from the government in the United States, and I wouldn't say if it's true, definitely true, but I'm sure that there has been efforts from the United States in every with Bush, with President Obama, and right now with President Bush, with President Trump, sorry, to change the Venezuelan government. I'm completely sure about that. But there's no other time where we can speak openly about what they're trying to do there right now. We have President Trump talking about a military intervention here in Venezuela. That's really important. That is something that has to be said, and that is something that most people are rejecting. It's weird here in Caracas, for example, some of Venezuelans are saying that they're open to a military intervention, and some of them are saying that it's really dangerous. Personally, I think it's outrageous. I mean, you can't even talk about something like that. You have examples in all Latin America and the Middle East about the consequences of that happening. In Venezuela, it would be a disaster, since it's not only position for Venezuela itself, that the military is really at its lowest point. It's more that it's just that you have to add the humanitarian crisis. So, yes, I agree that definitely you have to speak a little bit louder about, Washington's hand over Venezuela.
Mike Gonzalez, what would you add? And how would you respond to Lisa?
I'd add,
First of all, Allende was never accused of corruption, nor anybody in his government. It was absolute. That was an accusation. Every other accusation was leveled against Allende, but never corruption. The existence of corruption in Venezuela, well, there are quite solid figures, although they have to be derived because the Central Bank of Venezuela is no longer publishing statistics or data. It's very difficult to do it, but it can be done. For example, looking at the level of imports in the past and now, looking at what is probably the biggest growth industry in Venezuela today, which is currency speculation. But more importantly, on the question of imperialism, of course, one would never expect a Washington administration under Bush, and let alone under Trump, to approve in any way at all a political process which is designed to improve and assist the lives of the majority of the population and introduce participatory democracy. Of course, they're against it. There's a difficulty in Alejandro's description of the current opposition, the right-wing opposition, as being committed to liberal democracy. I don't see liberal democracy. I see violence in the streets, really of a most extreme kind, encouraged and sustained and probably paid for by the right. So, there are different members of the opposition to Chavismo, of course, but the opposition is largely led by a right-wing whose leaders are all members of the wealthiest families in the country. Of course, their interests are challenged, although, curiously enough, not nearly as much as they claim. Their interests are challenged, and their influence is challenged. Perhaps more importantly, their influence over prior governments, which they have lost or lost in part, that's what they want back. This is a battle about power. This is a group of people who have been in power, accustomed to being in power in the old state, and want to be back in power. They want to remove Maduro. But they don't want to introduce anything like a participatory democracy or restore the levels, the living standards of the poor at all. They don't stand for that. The challenge of Chavez beyond Venezuela was the creation of this kind of Bolivarian bloc, this idea of a group of progressive governments who would redirect oil revenues towards the poor and the needy. That was a challenge to every Washington administration, whichever they were, of course. But the reality also is that they are one enemy of the Chavista process. But the Chavista process itself is no longer what it was. And its claims to be representing the people are more grotesque and by the day. As today, for example, a report arises from the teachers' union, which says that the basic wage, it will take 21 basic wages to buy the base basket of minimum goods. The claims, the collapse that Alejandro mentioned, for example, are party's corruption, they're used as political levers. In other words, all those hopes have gone, and what there is now is something very like chaos. The interesting thing is, before this ends, we have to mention at least the election, current election to this, the new constitutional the new constitutional assembly, and compare the constitution which is likely to emerge from it, although nobody knows what it's going to be, to the 1999 constitution, not just in its content but also in the way in which it was debated and discussed and delivered through genuine grassroots discussion and activity. And this would certainly not be the case this time. The new constitutional assembly it consists of people who have hand-picked people from above, and the project is unclear. So this is a long way from the promise of Chavez.
Alejandro, your response?
Well, I mean, I think just in terms of the question of the opposition, yes, certainly vast sectors of it are aligned with sort of capital interests and conservative interests. And I think that Mike is right that largely what they seek is a return to power rather than the alleviation of the poor, sort of the suffering of the population. But that's not to say that their commitment to liberal democracy means a commitment to social justice. Quite the opposite. I think that their commitment to liberal democracy is founded on the idea that liberal democracy is, you know, sort of an expedient tool for elite sectors of the population, as it was, you know, before 1998, in order to be able both at the same time to cement their standing and their interests, while also proclaiming a kind of commitment to democratic values. So, you know, I guess I'm not counterposing here the idea of sort of, you know, democratic commitment to something necessarily positive. The fact is that, again, as I mentioned before, what Chavez did was really put on the table the notion that there are many different types of democracy, and that that really is part of what's at stake here. Beyond that, though, I think that the real challenge in Venezuela, and this also speaks to this thread of hopelessness that we were talking about before, precisely because popular sectors in Venezuela have a significant lack of trust towards the opposition that is not just longstanding, you know, before the Chavez era, but also skepticism around their claims to not just democratic engagement, but, you know, they're I'll just give you an example. So, you know, before this constituent assembly, the opposition had four, opposition united around this, the MOOD coalition, which is what it's called, had four major aims in terms of what they proclaimed that they wanted. Only the fourth and last one was humanitarian assistance. The first three were release of political prisoners, calling for elections, sort of a series of other kind of claims that didn't really speak to those, you know, the tremendous lack of goods and services that we've been talking about, which creates that sense of skepticism that the opposition also does not represent us, and that ultimately is what leads to this lack of hope that, you know, even if, you know, Maduro and Chavismo goes tomorrow, the situation may in fact be worse for them than better. And when you're bereft of options in that way, it's really quite dramatic, the level of desperation that leads to.
Mm-hmm. Anna, we have about 30 seconds left. Final thoughts from you. What are you, as a reporter in Caracas, what are you looking for next?
Well, basically, we're trying to find more people that are surviving this crisis. We are definitely, myself, I'm trying to survive this, what's happening in Venezuela, and we're just hoping to see, you know, our children, women and men go beyond of what is expected from every Venezuelan, from us, which is to fail in the quest of democracy, in the quest of real freedom, beyond politics and beyond any intervention from any other country, as I said before.
Ana Vanessa Herrero is a reporter with the New York Times in Caracas. She's been covering the crisis in Venezuela since it began in 2014. Mike Gonzalez is author of the Chavez biography. It's called Hugo Chavez, Socialist for the 21st Century. Alejandro Velasco is associate professor of Latin American history at New York University and author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. Ana, Mike, and Alejandro, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We'll can definitely continue to follow this issue, and be sure to check yourcallradio.org for a number of articles, including Anna's beautiful article about musicians who are rising up in Venezuela. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Ailette Waldman and Michael Chabon about their new book, Kingdom of Olives and Ash. It's a collection of essays by international writers that bear witness to the human cost of 50 years of Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. These writers, including Ailette and Michael, actually traveled to the West Bank and Gaza. So I hope you can join us for that conversation tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. You can listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. We're also on iTunes. You can leave us a review there. Thanks to Ali Budner for producing today's show. David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.